Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. At the National Gallery of Art on February 23, 2020, Mary Morton, curator and head of French painting, is joined in conversation with artist Anne Lofquist to discuss the exhibition True to Nature, Open-Air Painting in Europe, 1780 to 1870. Singling out particular paintings from the exhibition, Lofquist describes the influence of 19th century artists such as Camille Corot on her own practice of sketching in oil paint outdoors. Like these European painters, who were aesthetically energized by the light of Italy, Lofquist spent several years in California after a lifetime of painting in the Northeast. The conversation highlights a tradition begun in the late 18th century that extends to contemporary painting.
Good afternoon, everybody. Nice to see you on this beautiful spring day. Thank you for coming into the dark. I am Mary Morton. I'm the curator of French paintings here at the National Gallery. And I'm so glad you all came out for the second of the public programs that relate to True to Nature. It's a really sweet show. I hope you've already been in to see it, because what we're going to do today is really kind of drill down on about a third of the pictures that are hanging in the show. Now, the subject of the exhibition is the practice of outdoor oil sketching, practiced by artists from across Europe, from European art capitals, places like Berlin and London and Paris and Copenhagen, in order to complete their art education. And we're talking about late 18th and sort of the first half of the 19th century, they had to go to Rome and study antiquity, ancient architecture, ancient sculpture, Renaissance and Baroque painting and sculpture. And increasingly, sort of starting around the 1780s, 90s, but particularly in the first part of the 19th century, they started also fanning out into the Roman countryside and practicing oil sketching on little pieces of paper and board, taking their oil paints outside. And this became sort of codified by a guy named Valenciennes, and you'll see his quotations on the walls. We have a couple of pictures by him in the show. And he publishes in 1800 a treatise for young art students that continued to be read across the 19th century, in which he very specifically says, you have to go out into nature and practice transcribing light and topography and waterfalls and rocks, et cetera. So it became a tradition. And this tradition was lost to art history for the most part until the early part of the 20th century. Of course, the Impressionists claimed, the Impressionism as a movement starts in the 1870s, 1874 is the first exhibition, and the Impressionists claimed to have been the ones to release and free the practice of oil painting from the studio outdoors, right? That's the mythology of Impressionism. It actually turns out that most Impressionist paintings were not painted outdoors, and that this tradition far preceded Impressionism. It is a tradition that continues today. And so what I wanted to do was have a current plein air painter, landscape painter, come and talk about the pictures in the show and how they relate to her practice. And so in order to find the right person, I had this vision of finding a landscape painter who was sort of based in the north or the northeast, who had had the experience of several years of painting in Southern California, to liken this idea of these guys coming from the north in Europe, from these cold, dark, rainy places like Copenhagen and Berlin, and coming down into the Roman Campagna. And they write about the light, the magical light, and this beautiful topography. And I grew up in Los Angeles, and I've had many conversations with painters that arrive in town and talk about the light. They cannot believe how beautiful it is. It's so crystalline and clear, and the sunsets and the sunrises. So I called our friend, Craig Krull, who's a dealer in Los Angeles. I think he's one of the best dealers in California landscape painting, and told him what I was looking for. And he actually talked about a couple of people, but the first person that he started with was Anne Lofquist, who is based out of, for the most part, the Northeast, but spent some time in California. She is a plein air painter. She was born in Washington, D.C., went to Walt Whitman High School, and was trained, got her undergraduate degree at WashU in St. Louis, and her graduate work at Indiana University in Bloomington, And she has exhibited in New York City and Philadelphia and Los Angeles and San Francisco and Maine. And I'm just thrilled to have her here. We've been talking about these paintings for the last couple of weeks on the phone. And I sent her the PowerPoint. And the way that I found Anne to talk about these pictures that I've been spending years on, as a practicing artist, it really was driven home to me that, in fact, the practice hasn't changed that much, that many of the challenges that Anne faces every day going out to paint were the same challenges that these guys and girls are doing in the exhibition. So I want to thank Anne very much, Anne Lofquist, for joining us, and invite her. She's picked out some of her favorite pictures in the show, but also paintings that, you know, really speak to challenges that she's had herself out in the field. And so welcome, Anne. Thank you for coming.
It's a pleasure to be here, and I want to thank Mary Morton and the National Gallery. Growing up in Bethesda, I was so spoiled by having these wonderful public collections. And one misspent summer during my high school years, I would bike down to the National Gallery along the towpath, where we lived, just outside the city limit, and visit one painting a day. And it was just a wonderful thing. It was just come down on the mall, walk into the museum. There wasn't a lot of security then. And it really was, you know, kind of an important formative experience for me. But I think the reason that I'm here today instead of an art historian is because Mary said, when we were speaking on the phone, talking about me and these artists in the show, you're really all sort of playing in the same sandbox, aren't you? And that is really the way I look at these paintings. I look at them as the work of fellow artists who are dealing with challenges that I deal with, and I look at their successes or maybe struggles. And there's a sense of sort of shared endeavor. And unlike an art historian who's very interested in kind of historical precedent or what bears fruit in later artists, I tend to see all of these paintings almost as like the work of contemporaries. And so I'm going to be speaking about them that way. Mary can provide art historical context, but I'm not really the person for that kind of information. But I think hopefully I can give you a sense of what it's like to do plein air, and what the joys and the pitfalls are. The first slides that we have are paintings that actually depict artists out in the landscape. And among the kind of traditional academic subjects of painting, there's figure painting, there's still life painting, and there's landscape. Landscape has some kind of unique challenges because logistics of doing large paintings generally requires that they be done inside. But your subject is outside. And so how do you get the information into your studio? You can have a model come and pose for you, or you could set up a vase of flowers, but a landscape is a special challenge that way. Landscape also has a certain challenge in the transience of the atmospheric effects, of the time of day, the weather, the seasons, and so forth. And for an artist to try to make some kind of sense out of all of this change is very difficult. So artists began, as Mary said, earlier than we thought, actually going outside and directly observing nature. And I think it was seen as a kind of data collection. Certainly that's often what I think of when I'm going out painting plein air. And you can see the painters here. It seems like they tended to sit most of the time. A lot of contemporary artists prefer to stand, but the easels that they use are actually very similar to the French easels that are still used today. It was a great design that folds up into the shape of a box and is portable, and there hasn't really been any need to improve on it in 150 years. The umbrella is used to provide a kind of neutral, even light on your painting. If the sun is raking across your painting, or half of it is in sun and half in shadow, it's very difficult to manage your values and colors. The painting here shows a painter who is standing. The artist is usually holding his palette. They used wooden palettes back then, and some artists still do. The main technological invention since then is that we now have paint in metal tubes, which allows you to take a whole assortment of colors out with you. And these painters had to actually grind their own pigments, which are basically earth minerals, and mix them with linseed oil and put them in little like leather pouches. Some artists, instead of messing with that, would mix the painting, the paints in the studio, just arrange them on their palette and carry the palette out into the field. So this is a painting, or a photograph of a painter, a friend of mine named Marcia Burt, and me painting out in California. And she is using a traditional French easel, very much in the method of the painters whose work you're going to see in the show. I'm a little bit different. I prefer to sit on the ground whenever possible. I feel like I have more control if the painting is not close to vertical but tipped up, because I'm actually balancing my arm on my knee, you can see there, doing the work with the wrist. Here you can see my palette. I use paper palettes instead of wood, but unlike what Valenciennes recommends in his treatise that Mary mentioned, I like to put out a full palette of colors for every possible subject I'm painting. He recommended to the painters in the show that if you're, say, painting in the summer, you put a lot of greens, and if you're going to be painting a certain subject that has a lot of reds, you put those colors on your palette. I like to be open to unexpected things, and so even though in this case you can see my red paint hasn't been touched, it's there just in case. But this is my process. So Mary wanted me to talk a little bit about the light in California. And coming to California, I was raised on the East Coast, and I lived in Maine for 20 years and suddenly moved south. And she thought it might have been a sort of similar experience to a lot of the painters in the show. A large number of them are from Denmark. There was really active school of Danish painting, and they seemed to be real clubby, and they would come down to Italy together. Is that correct? But this is a painting by the French painter Bidot, but it feels to me like it could very easily be Southern California. And there's a quality in SoCal, and I did live a year in Italy, and I noticed it there too, of a kind of constancy to the light. You don't get a lot of cumulus clouds and light moving in and out of clouds. There's a kind of stillness. But a lot of people talk about the light in a certain place, the light in, you know, the Greek islands, or the silvery light in Finland. And I've thought about it, and I think that what we call light is actually a combination of more factors. The sun striking the earth at any given latitude is striking with the same force. And yet, in different places, even at the same latitude, there's a very different feeling evoked. And I think what we're really talking about is atmosphere, the moisture or smog in the air, combined with the actual color and structure of the landscape itself. And they come together to make some kind of alchemy that gives a really strong sense of place. And I think that somehow Southern California and Italy share certain qualities. This is one of my paintings done in SoCal, and you can see it's a view above Los Angeles. This is actually not a plein air painting. It's 7 feet long. But when I moved to SoCal from New England, I was used to doing paintings that were very much divided by trees and form. And suddenly you go to a place where the priority is space more than form, and certainly atmosphere. So I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the qualities that define plein air painting. And plein air, if you're not familiar with the term, basically means a painting done outside. I think, though, if you go and look at the show, you'll find that there are a number of different techniques or formats used by these artists. The kind of classical plein air is a painting that is basically done in one shot at one sitting of one place, obviously. And Valenciennes in his treatise says that 2 hours max per painting. And really, practically, the light changes so quickly in the landscape that unless it's kind of a high overcast day, which is a pretty constant effect, within 2 hours, the landscape will have changed so drastically that basically it's time to start another painting. And this is a little Corot that's in the show that is what I would consider a one-shot plein air painting. And you can tell these paintings certainly by a lack of high finish and detail that would take more time. But there, it also has an effect that we call wet into wet, which means that as the painting is done, the paint never has a chance to dry. And when you paint over dry paint, it has a very different look than when you're pushing wet pigment into wet pigment. The more you look at paintings, you can identify this. And this painting has the wet into wet quality. And you can see the signature at the bottom is actually inscribed into the wet paint, probably with the sharp tip of a brush, or some artists had painting knives. But he signed it while the painting was still wet, probably out in the field.
Let me just add a little bit to that. So it actually says, February, I think it's 1826. And like field notes. I think they're not actually putting their own names so much on these in the early part of the 19th century because they're not considered to be valuable. These are not paintings that are going to be exhibited or sold on the market, so there's no need to sign it. An artist putting a signature on a picture signifies that it's ready to go out into the public. But there are a lot of inscriptions on these little pictures, so look for those. Generally, they are like the day that it's painted, or the month, or the location. We have Anne Herningsvold with us today, who is, I think she has, as a paintings conservator and a technical art historian, has looked at more of these little sketches than anyone anywhere. But Anne has this idea that it almost becomes kind of show-offy, where they're showing, yeah, I did this, in 2 hours, and I'm going to prove that by, notating it into the wet paint.
Something else you'll notice about the paintings in the show is that almost all of them are done on paper. And when these artists, paper is a very kind of perishable support for a painting. And when they did something, important and legitimate, they would do a painting on linen or canvas. But paper provides certain qualities. For one thing, you can cut it down and change your composition, which you can't do with a stretch canvas. And paper has a different, it's hard to explain to someone who's not a painter, but it has a different touch and feel. The viscosity of the paint feels different on paper than it does on canvas. And oftentimes what you find is that the individual brush strokes hold their individuality on paper. And so they, rather than being absorbed into a canvas, they are sitting on the surface and give the paintings a really wonderful kind of active surface. But it was also probably for practical reasons that they could put all these dried oil paintings on paper into a portfolio and travel with them. This is a Giroux of Mount Vesuvius in the show, and it's funny seeing these little modest paintings blown up to these epic proportions. But what really strikes me about this painting is the economy that he used. If you look at the foreground, it suggests so much complexity with such simple description. And what's very interesting is he uses, in a lot of ways, the largest brush to describe the most complex part of the painting. And the mountain in the background, which is a big, simple shape, instead of taking his largest brush, it's actually dabbed and built up by small marks layered together. This painting is done on a brownish-colored ground. And you can see in the lower right and lower left corners, there's kind of a warm haze. And that was put down before he went out into the field. And a lot of us, myself included, still like to work on grounds. And the reason is, if you're working on a white piece of paper or a white canvas, every color that you put down is going to be darker than the surface you're working on. But if you have kind of a neutral brown or gray color, sort of like in the middle of the gray scale, you can actually start painting lights and painting darks and the relationship between lights and darks immediately. If you're working on white, it takes a long time until the values in your, value means relative light or dark. the values in your painting start to approximate something like what you're seeing. But it also, the warmth of the ground gives a kind of glow to this painting. I think it's a real beauty. Now, here we have a painting by one of these Danes named Eckersberg. And this has a really different look than the previous two I showed you, which were classic one-shot plein air paintings. And this is a painting, I look at it, and it's fun to try to figure out how did he do this? Because it's clearly the level of detail is not something that could be done in 2 hours. And yet it has this very strong specificity. It doesn't feel like it's invented, that this is a real place, and there's direct observation involved. So there are several options to an artist who wants to do this. One is to bring the painting back day after day to the same place and deal with the challenges of the atmospheric conditions being a little different each day, but you have more time. Another would be to start the painting outside and then bring it into the studio and with the aid of drawings and memory to add specificity. I have a feeling he did this painting by a combination of those two methods. I'll talk later on about what happens when you start to invent onto a plein air painting and the pitfalls there. And I don't see that in this case, but it doesn't have the freshness and immediacy of the previous two. And if you go back to the same place day after day after day, and the painting becomes kind of a composite of many experiences, you lose the sense of that kind of impression of the moment, but you gain something that's a little bit, it's a different kind of description. It's more kind of constructed and architectural. I mean, there is a reality to the landscape, even in pitch dark, you know, that the landscape has form that exists irrespective of light. And this starts to tap into that kind of more durable aspect of the landscape. But certainly it lacks freshness.
And it seems, just to add, it seems to be a particularly Danish thing and sort of a northern thing. And we have spent a lot of time in going through the hundreds of sketches thinking about the possibility of a national hand. And certainly I think the Germans and the Danes, they tend to not be able to walk away without a fairly meticulously finished image.
Well, who was it
image.
Who said, these Frenchmen are always painting and we're drawing?
Yeah, and then, it was a German, I believe, yeah. And complaining about these French who were so comfortable with their summary, you know, just banging these things out.
Well,
there's
something
very French about it, and I think there is actually something very French about it, but it's you can't really speak about it too responsibly. I mean, we're kind of in a very...
I think it's fun to go through the show and look at the paintings and say, is this done by a Scandinavian? And I believe it or not, I am half Swedish, so I guess I can say that with a smile. But there is a different quality to some of these Danish painters, and this is sort of an example. If you want to be unkind, you could say it's a fussiness, but it's not always a negative thing, as I'll show you later. The painting on top is in the permanent collection here. It's a Theodore Rousseau, who's a Barbizon painter, and it's an interesting piece. I try to figure out how did he do this, because unlike a lot of invented paintings, it has a real feel of specificity, but it does not have the feel of plein air. And my guess is that he did this painting looking out a window over the course of a number of days. And so it has that sort of generic feeling of multiple views of a landscape, not of a moment. And yet it has that sense of those trees were really there. He wasn't kind of going on autopilot and making something up. The painting below is interesting to me. It's another Rousseau, and it has sort of the looseness and freshness of a plein air, but it doesn't have the specificity of an observed painting. And so I'm kind of mystified. I'm not going to say this is what he did, but I think they're kind of a mysterious pair, and they're very close to each other in the show, and you can compare them yourself. Okay, here we have Giroux's paintings. Giroux was a successful, I would say, painter in France and recognized by the Academy. And on the left, we have a plein air painting of his, I think I would say a one shot. And on the right, a large oil on canvas that was clearly derived from the plein air. And the oil on canvas is not in the show, but I think it makes an interesting comparison because, as Mary said, these artists did not intend for their plein air studies to be seen. They were kind of data collection. They were a means to an end, and the end is the painting on the right. And just from my point of view, I find the plein air painting just so much more interesting to look at. And the question is, one, why? And number two, why did Giroux and his contemporaries value the painting on the right more? And it's a dilemma that I really face as an artist too, because I do plein air painting, and it's a very important part of my process. But somehow I feel like that alone is not enough, because what I'm doing is basically trying to subsume my ego, does that make sense, and be completely open to the unexpected occurrences of nature. But I think as artists, we all do have egos, and there comes a point where we want to construct our own world. And so what Giroux did is he took this real place and this real experience and reconstructed it himself. And the challenge is, how can we, in constructing our worlds, come close to vying with the complexity and beauty of nature observed? And so you look at his Salon painting, and to me, it gets very generic. He sort of repeats the same shapes over and over again, and there's so many unexpected things happening in the painting on the left that are not carried over. And it's a dilemma that artists face a lot. But you can see on the right, he had an idea. He wanted to have a kind of elliptical or almost circular composition going within the rectangle. And so he added elements that conform to that idea. The painting on the left is very, I would say, dynamically unbalanced. And maybe it's my contemporary eye, but I find that much more interesting than what he did on the left, which is kind of adhering to a convention, maybe. But it's interesting that is what he wanted posterity to judge him by, not that.
And it's, yeah, and so what Anne is talking about is so interesting because you see it reflected in art historiography and in critical discourse. And I think it's the reason that we've only just in the last couple of decades rediscovered these plein air sketches. And there's something sort of post, now that we've lived through Impressionism and post-Impressionism and the whole 20th century, we prefer the freshness. Mm-hmm. And poor Giroux, poor André Giroux, who, you know, went on to have a career, but is completely forgotten by art history. But when you go through the show, you'll see that when he was in Italy, he absolutely turned on. I mean, I think there were a couple of years there. This is what we're talking about. He's 18, he's 19, he's out of that competitive academic tunnel of tutelage, and he's sort of relaxing and innovating and experimenting on the spot. Then he will go back to Paris and go back into the tunnel, and sort of something is lost. So, you know, in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, when this mostly London-based group of young dealers, curators, and art historians started rediscovering this material, they really weren't recognizing the names because these guys had been sort of had fallen out of art history. So it's kind of fascinating that conversation continues through the historiography to our day.
Well, I have a few images to show you how I'm struggling with the Giroux problem myself. Here are a bunch of plein air sketches in my studio, and they're just, I do paintings on panel as opposed to paper, but they're all stacked up. It's sort of like, as I said, collecting data. And I think that these artists use their sketches the same way. And probably if you went in their studio, they had them all tacked up like postcards. Here's another wall. You can see by the watch the scale of the paintings. But here was this is a small painting, maybe about the size of a shoebox lid, done in Southern California. And this is a much larger painting that was done from that experience. And going back, go back and forth. I mean, it's the scale change is something that is lost when you're looking at images. But I gain something in the large painting, but I lose something too. It's always an issue I have to think that how am I adding something that is, that has merit, you know, that makes up for what I'm losing in the observation of nature. And it's sort of like the plein air painting is very intuitive, and this is more empirical. And I guess what I'm trying to do by sort of reconstructing these places is to search for something durable in the landscape beyond the conditions or the feeling of one moment. But I really feel a kinship with these artists whose studies are so praised now, and the work that they labored on so much is dismissed. But I think it's, for a lot of us as artists, it's just kind of human nature that we want to be the creator in our own cosmos, the cosmos being the painting. And in plein air painting, it's basically you're a vessel to receive information. And it's in a way a kind of passive, although very exciting, endeavor.
I mean, I'm just going to say one more time, it is precisely the issue that that sort of comes out of Impressionism and merges into post-Impressionism. And so the person to think about here, of course, is Cézanne, who had this problem with plein air painting. It's not enough, there's not enough sort of cerebral, almost, you know, humanist input. There is an ego issue, and this is really what Valenciennes was arguing for, is landscape painting as something that is more than just the passive transcription of nature. It's got, art has to be more than that.
Well, there's an interesting essay in the catalog, which I really encourage you to buy if you like the show, about how landscape painting was sort of seen as sort of the ugly sister. You know, it was the least respected of a lot of the painting genres. And so the landscape painters, they felt like they had to include classical allusions in their paintings, that they were educated, and that it was their job not to depict nature, but to ennoble nature. And I think that's why a lot of them go to Italy, because of the connection to classical antiquity. But it's interesting that, going back to Girard here, he would probably say that the painting on the right is ennobled, whereas the painting on the left is simply detached observation, which is not elevating the landscape. And I think that notion is something that is not in favor now, and we find the detached description of nature to be something very emotional and successful artistically, but that was his point of view. So this is just another painting of mine for New England before I went to California, and you can see how I would compose with stuff. But this is also a painting that was invented. I did a lot of plein air studies of different kind of trees, and I just completely made them up out of scraps of information. And I'm going to talk about the dangers of, or the pitfalls of invention, because as I said, it's almost impossible to compete with the variety of shapes and colors and experiences we perceive in nature. And as an artist, I have a limited imagination. And so it's mine. It all came out of me, and yet in some ways it's less interesting than what I'm simply observing. And yet I feel this need to do this. And so like I said, the painters in this show, I think, maybe they didn't struggle with it, maybe they were at peace with it, but they all dealt with this issue in some form or another. Okay, so the show is organized, the rooms are organized not according to nationality or time sequence, but by motifs and subjects. And we don't have time to talk about them all, but I'm going to talk about a few. And so I have a few examples of paintings that involve trees, which are, I think, the secret dread of a lot of landscape painters. And the reason is that a tree has, for practical purposes, I would say infinite complexity. I mean, there's a finite number of leaves on that tree, but from our point of view, we can't paint them all. And so you have to find some kind of approximation for this complexity. You have to suggest without being slavishly descriptive. And in the kind of academic studio paintings, I think painters were taught a pretty specific manner on this is how you paint trees. It was almost kind of like Bob Ross. He has a certain brush for painting happy trees. And I mean, this is a much more sophisticated manner, but conceptually, it's akin to that. That, okay, there's a certain kind of mark you use or shape to make foliage, and it's sort of like a kind of cauliflower effect. And you see it over and over again in academic painting. And so you look at this painting here, and this is a Bidot, and I look at the trees in the foreground, and he's clearly out there observing, but he brought that manner learned in the academy out into the landscape. Rather than kind of surrendering himself to what he really saw, he was kind of imposing sort of the more conceptual concept of what he expects to see. And the painting, I actually like this painting. I think that the straight line of that mountain in the context of the curves is an example of something that is really hard to invent. And it's a kind of specificity that has to be observed. And yet when it gets down in the foreground, I would warn my students, don't go on autopilot. And I feel that's what he did here. He started just saying, okay, this is my tree technique. And he starts putting it in rather than really observing patterns of light and shade. So look at the artist trees in the show, and you'll see some of them are really loath to let go, especially with trees, of this kind of acquired manner that they learned in their ateliers, is that what you call it? So here we have a painter by a Dane named Petzold. And this painting is very striking because the observed color relationships are very unexpected and not what you would see in an academic painting in terms of whether the shadows register warmer or cooler than the highlights. There's a great range in here. The shapes of the foliage have this sense of not being an autopilot kind of generic way of painting trees, but being truly observed. It's really a very abstract painting, and I think he really saw it kind of like as a tapestry of different kind of green shapes. But it's free of that mannerism that you see in a lot of the other trees. Here's a painting that's later in time. It's almost getting up towards what we would call Impressionism, right? This is late 1860s. And this was a subject that where the academic manner of the cauliflower trees just doesn't work. And so he has to come up with an alternative way to describe all this complexity of these olive leaves. And so he came up with this kind of broken mark, which in many cases you can see through. And it seems like a really exciting moment where sometimes we artists go out in the field and we see something and we just say, how do I describe that? There has to be some kind of pattern or system to describe that, but none of sort of my bag of tricks work. And it's really exciting when you basically find that there's sort of a symphonic pattern of shape and color, and you tap into that. And I feel that's what happened in this painting.
And clearly not done in one shot. In fact, the inscription, which is right down here, basically says that it's near Tivoli. I think he says that it's near Tivoli. And it puts the dates, and it's about 6 or 7 days mm-hmm. in the summer in a particular year. So he's clearly, he is coming back every day at the same time and continuing with his composition.
It's a strange painting. It's very odd composition. I'm kind of weak at the bottom, and I don't know if I like it or if I don't
I love this painting. I really love this painting. I love that you can sort of see through the screen of trees to the sculpture of the background. And then I'm a sucker for olive trees. I mean, they're so beautiful. The trunks and the branches, they're sort of almost anthropomorphic. And then there's that particular silvery green that you get with olive tree leaves. I love this painting. Anyways, I'm so glad that,
we
were having
this.
But
he is able to suggest the complexity of millions of leaves by coming up with a pattern that is, you know, very challenging to do. But it's interesting to see artists come up with these solutions. This is just an example. This is a really gray looking slide, but one of my paintings of sycamore trees out in California. And I tend to try to see everything as a shape. Some shapes are very tiny and almost become pattern. In a way, there's a sort of evenness of treatment of the subject, that I look at the sky as a shape, the pattern of colors in the tree as a shape. And if you step back from the painting, hopefully it comes together to form an illusion. But up close, it's really a very abstract treatment of the subject. I've done a number of paintings of leafless trees, which to me are the ultimate challenge for a plein air painter, because you have to find, once again, some kind of pattern of light and color that approximates thousands of little branches, because you know it's beyond your ability in 2 hours to paint all these things. This is a sycamore tree in central, like near Santa Maria. Here's the same tree, probably a different month. I like to go back to the same places again and again, but that's some of my trees. I have a few images here of paintings from the show dealing with coasts and water and the challenges therein. And these are two paintings done by two Danish painters that are obviously at the same spot. We don't know if it was done on the same day. Obviously, one is done at a different time of day. But these paintings have a very high amount of detail coupled with a really strong sense of a particular time. So my guess is probably they went back. You know, the guy on the right went back several times in the morning, and the guy on the left maybe several times in the afternoon. But it also strikes me how faithful they are, that if you look at the rocks from one to the other, they're the same rocks. And so they weren't kind of just saying, oh, I'm going to change my mind. I think it would be nice if there's an open space here, and interpreting the subject that way. They're being faithful and trying to get the inspiration from nature. I mean, I think the painting on the left, the composition's a little weak at the bottom left, and it might be improved if he had moved those rocks around. But that was not his priority. His priority wasn't to do, you know, a nice little piece to put on your wall. It was to really learn about rocks. And this is just a little painting of mine of a similar subject. This painting's probably about 4 by 4 feet or 4 inches. But you can see there are waves and water in here, but they're pretty simple as broken down into kind of little geometric swatches of color. But there are examples in the show of artists really trying to paint waves. And here are two examples. And it's really hard to impress on people how hard this is to paint. And especially we who are so conditioned by seeing so many photographs of waves that we know what a wave looks like. But back in this time, photography was unable to capture, you know, forms that weren't still, even though photography was, you know, starting to come in. But basically what you have to do to paint the subject is you have to wait. You put down a few strokes, then you wait, you know, 30 seconds until the next sequence and the wave comes back. And then you paint a few more strokes. And it's extremely hard to do. And I don't think either of these guys quite pulled it off, but probably what there is, we know, since we've seen all these photographs, is there's a simpler structure of colors and shapes in the waves. And they got a little bit too complicated. But I think they're really heroic efforts. And I don't have any paintings of this subject on my own. This is the closest I could find. And even in this case, this is up around Big Sur, I had to wait. You know, the wave would come in and then it would slosh all the way out and you'd see rocks all the way to the top of the painting. Then it would come back. It's sort of like you're at attention. And when it's right, you grab it. This is a painting. This is another water painting, but a waterfall, which is much easier subject than a wave. Because a waterfall pretty much keeps the same shape. It's basically a question of edges, that the softness of the edges give the quality of movement. But I think this is really an interesting painting. It from a distance, reads very sharp and realistic. But if you look at the way the left-hand part of the painting is treated, it was another instance where the artist is faced with almost infinite complexity of rocks and of different colors and the green, you know, sod on the rocks. And instead of trying to figure it out, he surrendered to that complexity. And he said, okay, I'm not going to worry. What's a rock? What's grass? I am going to see what kind of abstract pattern, what is the music? What are they really doing together? And in a lot of ways, it's a kind of impressionist sensibility. But I think I would try to encourage my students to do this kind of surrender. And as a byproduct, when you step back from it, it looks very illusionistic. But up close, it is really abstract. And the success or failure is whether you get the right pattern. You know, are the shapes distributed correctly? You know, are they the right colors, the right character? But as a comparison, I have this image, which is, you can see, a Danish painting, kind of fussy. But this painting, by comparison, this artist, he tried to figure it out. You can see that he painted the rocks, he painted there's kind of a conceptual separation going on in his mind where the opposite is taking place here. And I don't want to make a value judgment that one is better than the other. This is sort of based more in drawing. This painting has qualities that the previous one lacks. It suggests kind of geologic forces pushing towards the center of the painting. You know, there's meaning in a painting beyond just illusion, but it doesn't have that sense of specificity of one day and one moment, one condition, atmospheric condition, one experience that the previous painting has.
And it's fun. I mean, what you can't see from where you're sitting, and you can barely see it in person when you're standing in front of this picture, is the force that created this extraordinary canyon, which is hinted to over here. There's sort of a plume, so clearly there's some kind of crazy waterfall over around the corner. And there's an artist in here standing up on the ledge. I literally cannot see him. There he is. He's right there. And so there is, I think, there is a kind of geological sort of love and drama to the way that he's conveying what he's saying. It's not just a field note.
It's a more subjective treatment rather than a more detached treatment about sort of surrendering yourself to the visual, the kind of poetry of the shapes. This is actually kind of trying to say something about the landscape. And, you know, which you are attracted to is a question of temperament. I like both treatments. This is one of my paintings of Yosemite. I have these sketch journals that I do watercolor and gouache in, but these are works on paper. But once again, this compared to painting waves, this is a walk in the park, literally. This is another waterfall in Southern California. Once again, not an oil painting, but a waterfall. Maybe about an hour and a half for 2 hours for that painting. Yeah, here we have a Bidot in the show that is clearly an observed painting and yet has a degree of finish. And there's an expression called a licked surface. It's where you almost can't see individual brushstrokes. Everything's sort of blended together. It almost starts to have that kind of surface. And yet it feels very, very real and very specific. And I think he came back multiple times to this same place to do this. And it, I mean, the way that shadow would move in the upper right-hand corner must have been really hard to deal with. But it's really a wonderful painting. And if you look at some of Bidot's kind of invented paintings, this composition, I think, is really interesting. And you just, the more you look at it, the more you see more. I think this, in his work, is a great compromise between kind of generic invented paintings and plein air paintings that maybe don't have that kind of love. Obviously, he has a love of describing detail.
And it's a famous waterfall. It's the waterfall at Tivoli. Yeah.
Oh,
okay. So, and you can actually look at other painters' paintings of this waterfall and recognize this little piece. But Tivoli was one of the main points on every artist sort of concours, sort of a course that they made out into the Roman Campagna. And so he's almost coy about not including the great Temple of Cybele, which is up at the top, that would instantly make you recognize this as Tivoli. But it's got that kind of resonance, and I think most painters would have recognized exactly what little piece of waterfall it was.
I have some images of kind of special effects paintings, nocturnes and sunsets and things that I like to paint. I love this moment right when the sun is about to go down. Dawn is really hard for painters to paint because you have to be set up in the dark before the sun rises. And you had to get up early in the morning. And these guys had to probably ride a mule out somewhere into the field. Dusk is much easier because it's easier to pack up when you're done. But you really oftentimes only have about 15 minutes to capture the effect. This is of Mount Vesuvius, seen from a distance. Here's a painting of the Campania at dusk. And that kind of pink effect is so fleeting, but so wonderful. And when I do paintings of this subject, what I do is kind of cheat. And I go out in the morning or on a previous day, and I do kind of underpainting or like a very loose drawing where everything is, and have it dry. And so basically it's a ground with images. And so when I come in to paint, you know, and I only have a few minutes, everything's already basically in place for me. And all I have to do is just touch the colors in. And in painting the sky, I wouldn't paint that whole shape. I would just put like a little color swatch of that blue. And then maybe later on in the studio that night, I would fill it in. But you have to almost kind of make up a shorthand to be able to do this. This is kind of a odd little painting. We don't know what to make of it. This is Simone Denis. And why don't you talk a little about this?
I mean, we love Simone Denis, who, again, made major sort of neoclassical landscape paintings that have been forgotten. But he was a persistent sketcher, oil sketcher outside. And we just discovered in the last 20 years, he had this system, this categorizing system, where he would turn over his sketch after making them and put a number on it. And 1 to 50 was rocks, and 50 to 100 was clouds, and 100 to 150 was waterfalls. And he had this whole notation system for when he brought everything back to his studio. So Anne and I were looking at this picture, and Anne's like, because we're calling it View of Tivoli at Night is the title on the wall. And Anne's like, I don't think this is at night. I think this is at dusk, and that's not the effect of a nocturne at all. And I said, actually, on the reverse is the number notation by Denis, and it says View of Tivoli at Night. So in this case, we actually have documentation. But he's a funny guy, and I think he also goes back in and anecdotalizes this picture, just like the Kuhn. He's got these lightning bolts coming in out of nowhere, and there's a little fellow running across the ridge there, sort of exclaiming at the lightning that's hitting the tree, and it's, you know, he decided to, I mean, he's funny that way, but it's a beautiful little, I think, very responsive to the conditions of this nighttime view of Tivoli. But
I don't know what to make of it. Coloristically, I have a lot of problems with this painting. It has the looseness of a plein air painting, but the colors, what you observe in nature is that if light is striking something, the highlight in the shadow is not just black added to the highlight. The shadow is actually a color of its own that has a different intensity or warmth or coolness. And this feels almost to me like kind of a tinted drawing, that he added white to the lights and black to the darks in a lot of the painting, and it has no vibrance. And yet, it's clearly very dramatic. I like the shape of the ruin and the kind of negative shapes between the columns, but...
Okay, we'll take that.
Okay. Here are some of my nocturnes that were probably maybe about 5 by 5 inches, going back to the same spot. So this, you know, I would go back to the same places. So I would come ready, you know, the thing would already be sketched out and dry. And then I would touch in the colors at these moments. When I moved to Southern California, I was so disappointed. There, I like to paint streams and moving water, and there's no water in the rivers out there. So the highways became kind of my surrogate streams. And I did a lot of paintings of the freeway systems at dusk. And this is PCH. This is a larger painting that was sort of derived from all those studies. And on the tip of that little promontory is supposed to be Bruce Willis's house. So somehow he has to find this painting, or you could buy some of these.
Put a figure in there, just like the guys in our show. There's a hiker cruising through the hills. So
these are two paintings of grottos that are next to each other in the show. And my sister was walking through the show with me today. And she said, you know, I really like the one on the right more than the one on the left. And I said, yeah, I agree. And she's like, why is that? And I said, well, I'll try to tell you in the talk. But the painting on the left is done by one of the few female artists in the show. And I'd like Mary to tell you a little bit about her and the challenges she faced. But before we get her biography, I've noticed in her paintings in the show, they have a kind of finish to them. And I think she did her work outside. They were real kind of wet into wet plein airs. But then she took them back in the studio and kind of tinkered with them and added these little tendrils of vines. And it's a really strong temptation when you bring in a painting to start fussing with it. But once you lose that freshness, it's almost impossible to get it back without going back out into the field. And I think this is an example of a painting that I probably would have liked when she brought it into the studio. But the added elements have that kind of generic autopilot mannered look to me. And they detract what I think the painting is really about, which is about this very interesting group of shapes, you know, the circle once again inside the square. Whereas the painting on the right, instead of fussing with it, the shapes are very carefully observed. And can you see how the shapes in the Louise's painting on the left start to have a little kind of generic similarity to them? Whereas there's such an unexpected quality to the shapes on the right. It's really hard to invent shapes that good. In college, I was an abstract painter. I know this. You tend to want to repeat yourself. And the unexpectedness of these shapes and the kind of two destinations into the space on either side of the column, it's something that is really hard to make up. And by being faithful to what he observed, I think he came up with a really stunning little painting. But can you talk about Louise?
Sure. But there's still some pretty slides that we want to get to, so I think we should keep moving. We talk about her in the book, in the catalog, but she's this incredible figure that not that much is known about. There hasn't been enough deep work on her, but I think that is going to change in the next couple of years, hopefully. She comes up in the late 18th century and cannot go to the École des Beaux-Arts because they don't allow female students. So she actually takes private lessons with Valenciennes, our main protagonist in all of this, and he trains her, helps her learn how to do landscape painting, and she spends most of her career painting landscapes in Italy and sending these things back and actually supporting herself through the sale of her Italian landscape paintings, including pictures like this, sketches that are brought up a little bit and then sent back for sale. So I think that's why she doesn't have the liberty of just sort of doing this kind of work and then not trying to sell it.
Right, that a lot of, Mary told me, or she's, the catalog says that many of the paintings in the show were never intended to be exhibited or sold. But she actually had to make a living selling these paintings. And I think that's why she probably felt the need to make them comply to a sort of the standard of the times, that a landscape should have this sort of a fussy detail in it. And it, you know, it's kind of a shame, but she was out there, you know, a true pioneer for women like like me, but this is another Danish painter, right? And this is not an Italian subject, but I thought it was just a really interesting example of, once again, someone being confronted with a subject of almost incredible complexity and coming up with a solution that's not kind of an academic manner. Like if you look at the pile of logs next to that little pink addition, if you look at it in the show, the way it's painted, he is not painting logs. He came up with a kind of texture and a pattern that suggests millions of logs, but the actual description is so economical. It was probably done, you know, with one pass of the hand. And that is so exciting to see when to achieve as an artist. When you're faced with something, I don't know how I'm going to describe this, and yet you unlock the key to that pattern that's there. This is a painting of Capri that isn't attributed to anyone. There are two paintings you'll notice in the room that both have a very dark blue sky. And I think I've never been to Capri, but people there come away with this sense of the baking white light on the stucco and the blue sky. And these artists were faced with a challenge to try to paint something that is kind of technically impossible with oil paint. And the same occurs when you're trying to paint the sun itself. The oil paint itself is like toothpaste, and it's impossible for it to hurt your eyes by being so intense, right? It's just not its character. So to suggest that kind of intensity of light, you have to manipulate things, and it's done very subtly, that the sky is a much darker value than a blue sky at noon ever is. But the degree of difference makes the light feel really powerful. And I think it's very creative that he did that. There's a second example in the show. So at the end here, I just have three images of plein air paintings I really like. And I think I just want to end by talking about what I think sort of the spirit and the appeal of plein air is. This is a Corot that's in the permanent collection that was one of my paintings I visited when I was in high school. You know, if we talk about fussiness as a problem for some painters, there's just this wonderful kind of detachment of seeing the world as this sense of interlocking shapes. And yet it comes together, and I don't think the emotional effect is detached. The process might have been, but it's a very strong evocation of a human experience in a real place. Another, this is the Colosseum. This is a northern painter, but not fussy at all. This is a wet into wet one-shot deal. I think a just beautiful simplicity of patterns of basically four colors. But when you get up close to paintings like this and you look at them, they really are very abstract in their treatment. And yet when you step back, it's a place, it's an experience, it's an illusion. And so the painting simultaneously has its feet in these sort of two realities. And I think there's a kind of magic in that that appeals to all of us and certainly appeals to me. Here, we started with Coignet, and here's another of Lake Nemi. And this is the last image. I find this painting very emotionally resonant. You know, the end of the day, and it has a sense, a kind of evocation of the past or some of time to me. And so I thought it might be a closing image, but once again, a very simple, quick, kind of abstract image that very strongly evokes specificity and what it is to be human in the landscape. So
beautiful.
Thank you.
That's so beautiful. Thank you, Anne.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast. Thank you.